Okay, welcome guys on the morning session regarding hackers' perspective on your infrastructure. So what we're going to talk about is the mandatory checklist for a hacker that hacker needs to take to be able to get into your infrastructure. And even though it sounds maybe like a small story, of course, let me tell you what I'm doing for a living, and then maybe we will, of course, get the message why the approach, whenever you are a hacker, it's so important. So my name is Paula Januszkiewicz, and what I do for a living, it's security. I'm a penetration tester, so security is my hobby. I got a husband that is also a penetration tester. Security is definitely my passion, and security is my regular work. So what I do, I get inside the customer infrastructures. So I'm a kind of on the bad side, but at the end, I'm on the good side because I really take care about infrastructures being definitely secure. I'm also a trainer within a Secure Academy. This is our company's academy that we created because we get into conclusion that within the security market, people need to know how really things within operating system work. And this is something that if you are interested in security, you definitely should attend. So if you do have questions, of course, please feel comfortable anytime. And if you do not, let me get you to our tools. So I always share the tools within the sessions, and this time, of course, as well. If you go to the website and if you go to the tools tile, if you click on there, you're going to find out a lot of tools that are used within this session and in my previous sessions, and I really hope that you're going to find them useful. There is one tiny thing, of course, if you are thinking about clicking within the or using the tool or clicking on any kind of executable within the production environment, within the icon that has a raccoon in it, definitely please do not do it because I don't want to be responsible for the infrastructure crash. As you know, probably I do like raccoons, and anything evil that we've got, it has a raccoon icon, so just a small warning. If you are wondering if the tool is a good or not, it's definitely not. This website, TZWorks, is actually a really cool website within the tools that you can use within forensics. Not only forensics, of course, we're finding out how Windows works and how to trace certain things. So we're gonna leverage the existence of this tool today, and I would like to show you how we are able to get access to the drive and how we are able to find out if files were changed or not, for example, with NTFS Journal. Regarding the session goal, just a couple of things. I like to travel a lot, and I do really travel a lot. Every week I'm somewhere else in the world, like literally I spend Saturdays at home, sometimes I'm even dead. And I do have my own packing list. And when I think what I should take with me, it's gonna be probably some pens, some shorts, some socks, and of course, all the needed stuff that you need for travel. But whenever we are thinking about what's the hacker's mandatory checklist, every time the hacker approaches the company, that kind of checklist, it's strictly defined. And my goal for today is to show you how hacker acts, what can be the hacker's goal, and what kind of areas in operating system can be used by a hacker. So let's dig in into agenda. My agenda is usually very simple. As you see, we do have a beginning and the end and a mandatory checklist. So let's dig in into a checklist. And let me talk about the first thing that we should know whenever we are a hacker, which is, of course, staying anonymous. If you want to stay anonymous, there are a couple of things available within the web that you can use. And first of all, we need to think about the reason why you would like to stay anonymous. Obviously, whenever you're going to connect to the certain infrastructure, even for their internal research, for the initial research, then whenever you are approaching that infrastructure's appliances, they're gonna get you in the logs. So sooner or later, they're gonna check out all of the IP addresses that were approaching them, and maybe they can go back to you. So from the very beginning, what you need to do is to stay anonymous. And one of the nicest way and the easiest way to stay anonymous, it's a Tor network. This is the network, there's a Tor project available that you can use for free, well, in most of the cases for free. And this is the network that has something that is called an exit nodes. And these are the nodes that you are using to go out from the network that allows you to, of course, stay anonymous. So your traffic is bouncing around a certain host. And that's why the project was created, to keep the privacy. But sometimes, unfortunately, the network is used for the goals that are not very clear. For example, if you are wondering where some of the distributed denial of service attacks may come from, this is one of the places. So another thing to stay anonymous, another solution to stay anonymous, it's a proxy, very VPNs, of course. We've got the dial-ups, which is kind of old school. And we do have something that is called host bouncing. Of course, all these techniques can be connected all together. So you can be, for example, establishing a connection somewhere, so VPN somewhere, and then you're going to go to another host, and then to another host, and then to another host. So this is something that is typical and usage of proxy. It has been within the internet for so many years, and I'm really sure that I don't have to dig in into details what proxy is. And the funny thing here is that if you would like to stay anonymous, well, at the very beginning it's very easy because you just approach a certain infrastructure and then you try to find out what kind of services are running and accessible from the outside. But of course, if you would like to get inside and if this is your goal, what you need to think about is how these people or these machines from the inside are going to connect back to you. And that's where the problem begins, because you stop being a little bit anonymous. People will connect to somewhere. And of course, you can set up whatever you're going to learn, whatever you're going to run inside the infrastructure in a way so that it's going to search for a certain name and you're going to use the dynamic DNS and so on. But still, people will be connecting to you. So this is a little bit more difficult to implement. Whenever we are thinking about anonymizing the traffic, I do have, of course, a little demo for you. And that demo is going to be about connecting to the Tor's network. To be able to connect to the Tor's network, what you need to have, it's, of course, the Tor's browser or another client that's going to anonymize the traffic. And let me show you how we are able to do that. So first of all, I'm going to come back to my machine. Here we go. And what I've opened, let me do the full screen mode, is the Tor browser versus the regular Internet Explorer browser. Let me refresh what's my IP address so that we can see where we are right now. And this is Internet Explorer. I'm not using any kind of Tor connection right now. So your IP address is an SUC. And this is a Tor browser. So I'm going right now through the Tor's network. And you will see in a moment that my IP address, it's a little bit different. So basically, having this in mind, let me, of course, refresh the website. We need to go to that network and then be able to get the IP address back. How, of course, we are establishing this connection? Well, there are many clients available, but one of the easiest tools that you can get, and you see there is a different IP address available. So it's kind of strange. Have a look. We've got here one IP address, and this is another IP address that we've got. So one of the ways how you can hide yourself is, for example, by using the Tor's browser. And the Tor's browser is to be downloaded from the Tor project. It's just a bunch of files. You see, you've got a start Tor browser. And if I double click on it, I do have already connection established. So it's going to tell me that I cannot do it. But it opens really fast. And here, of course, you are able to browse the Tor network. So this is very simple demo, of course, and that shows that whenever you would like to stay anonymous, there's a couple of ways of being the one, and Tor is, I would say, the first thing that you're probably going to go to. Okay, guys. So the next thing to talk about, whenever we already anonymize our traffic, is to know your victim. And even though it sounds like a maybe simple story, of course you need to know your victim if you would like to attack this person, then it's not as simple. Sometimes whenever you are planning an attack and targeting attack, that can last for months. Whenever we are doing the social engineering projects, of course you need to know who you're talking to. And I'm not talking about technology here. Technology is also important because at the end you're going to end up with technology. But we need to know, for example, what kind of stuff this person likes. Who is this person? Is this person vulnerable to social related stories? So what are the habits of this person, of course? Maybe this person has some interests. So this is something that we need to, of course, become familiar with. Whenever we are thinking about knowing your victim from the network perspective, there is a couple of things to have a look at. Remember that whenever you do the research, one of the things that you need to check is that whenever you're going to do the research, You need to stay anonymous. So what kind of services these guys have? What kind of ports are running there? What's the business model? What's the strategy? Is this company, for example, within that range of business, or maybe something else? So whenever we are thinking about knowing your victim within such case and knowing what administrator likes, I prepared a tiny website. So let me show you. I'm gonna, of course, open it in a moment within a certain scenario, but let me show how the website looks like. I'm gonna log on to the machine, and then let me go here, and let me launch the full screen. Okay. So let me open up the website. This is a website that, of course, you can access from the internet. And let me open it here. Very good. And of course, if you are watching this presentation right now, you probably can access the web page, but please do not run the script on your computer. It looks very nice from the beginning, and it is a nice script, and it's a nice looking script. Whenever you read it, it looks legit. So let's have a look. Let's say the administrator that we are trying to establish a connection with is interested in PowerShell scripts. So this is something that is a kind of natural thing for administrators. So over here, we do have a script that we are using for listing services. And the goal of the script is actually pretty nice because we are supposed to list all of the services within the infrastructure that are running on the accounts that are not the built-in accounts. So they are not local service, network service, and the local system. The reason why we are searching for such accounts is that because whenever account is used, so the not the built-in account is used for service, then the password of that account is going to be in the registry of the certain operating system. And it's a fact, and I'm going to show you later. So whenever, for example, administrator is having a look at the script, there is no like a download button or something like that. And I'm not saying the download button will make it even more safe, but what will administrator do in such case, it's going to just select the whole thing like that and copy it and paste it within the PowerShell. Okay, guys, so let's have a look for the moment in the slides. So the next step that we've got is to attack someone. And we're not thinking about technology here. Of course, it might be, but it might be also from the social perspective. Taking a look into a statistics, it's pretty interesting how often the home users are attacked by a malware that, for example, encourages them to pay because they have a certain viruses running on their computer. Of course, it's a very easy example, but lately I've heard about very interesting malware that whenever the user entered the web page, there was a div on the web page, and underneath there was a downloaded PDF. And just because user had Adobe Reader that wasn't up to date, he got the malware through opening. He didn't even know that he's opening the PDF. But the malware came through an opening, a malicious PDF, and that's how things get into someone's computer. And later on, what happened is that this person had a disk encrypted, and later on there was a pop-up within which there was a message that user needs to pay $200. And this is the only way the user can get the data back because all of the data was encrypted. So this is a kind of terrible story, but it doesn't sound very uncommon. I'm traveling a lot, I told you, and when one of the hotels I was trying to print out some boarding pass or some other stuff, and what I saw is that Windows Vista something antivirus was running over there. And even if I said to the reception that, hey, listen, there is something wrong going on with your computer, they said, oh, no, we don't have an antivirus installed, so everything is okay. Well, people treat that kind of messages kind of seriously. So it's pretty nice to cheat on the regular users. But of course, sometimes our ambition is not to get the user's privileges, but to get the administrator's privileges. And I think that that's where the problem begins. Because who is the guy that likes the scripts? And it's going to be an administrator. User cannot even run it. So naturally, we are leveraging our position that administrators are the guys that run software, that of course run scripts, that are interested in cool stuff, cool tools, and so on. So we can of course take this into consideration. And that's what we're going to do in my next demo that says scripts are cool. So let's have a look. I'm going to open up that machine that we've got within the script. Here we go. So I'm going to copy the whole stuff. I already did it, but just in case it's available. And then what I will do, I'm going to run and copy that script over here. So what happened is that administrator had a look and it's like, well, this is something that I like. And I mean, seriously, guys, if you open up this webpage, the script is good. It's actually pretty good. So if you want your services to be listed, which of the services are misconfigured, and you want that to have everything colored, this is awesome. And that script definitely is going to help you. But please do remove one tiny thing from the script. You cannot see it right like that. So what I will do right now, I'm going to launch the script. I mean, just as you see, it's pasted. So I'm just going to launch it. And I'm going to list all of the services. The script actually is working. I mean, everything is okay with the script. And you see the colors, all the configuration of the services is fine. And here you see that I do have one service running as an administrator, and there is an executable over here. And this is red, which means that service is wrong. Very cool. But what I would like to show you within this web page, so let me go back. If you go here and if you go to the view source, what you can see within the source of the web page is the on copy action. And this is not a script. You are actually downloading malware from one of the websites. So you see that there is a malware ini, it's a configuration file for the malware. There's a couple of also other things. There is a registry keys to be added. And here you've got some very characteristic string that I'm going to talk about in a moment. There's supposed to be somewhere, I don't see it right now, a DLL. Oh, here we go. I'm sorry. Here we go. So there's a DLL. And that particular DLL is actually pretty interesting because it's already in your computer. Because even though it might be, for example, the case of the user being a local administrator, great, and being also a domain user. It doesn't really matter. If you are a local administrator, of course, you can configure all of that stuff. You can add and edit registry keys. You can install a certain operating system extensions. And that particular DLL, it's nothing but a DLL that's going to be running through the WinLogon, so launch through the WinLogon. It's called LSA Provider. And that particular DLL is going to be launched whenever you log on, of course. So I'm going to show you everything. If you would like to check out all of the details about that particular DLL and all of the registry keys that right now have been added, of course, I need to open the registry right now, so let me enlarge it. And if I go to the following key, let me show you how the key sounds. So we've got software, Microsoft Windows, current version, authentication, credential providers, and then you search for something strange. And I mean, based on that, you don't really see what is good, what is bad. So here, if I like double click, I mean, there's nothing inside. There's only one thing here, that's it. So here you've got a smart card reader selection provider, smart card WinRT provider. I mean, I could make up these names. Picture password login provider. We know what picture password is, but generic provider, what's that? Is it legit? So our string, it's also, of course, over here. Let me refresh that key. And as you see, there is a string that appeared. And it's called sample credential provider. So since now, we're going to use some very strange provider that whenever we log on, this is something that's going to take care about, and the question is what? Running the code, reading our passwords. So basically, we will see. The only reason why I'm putting it like that, why I'm executing it like that, is to show you the point of entry. Of course, we can have many points of entry like that, but this one is particularly interesting because you use PowerShell scripts. So whenever we focus on the next step, and this is the next step on the hacker's checklist. So first of all, we'll stay anonymous. Then we had the discussion about, of course, knowing our victim and how we are supposed to attack users. The next step that we need to take is to be persistent. Because if you jump into someone's infrastructure, you need to avoid a situation that, oh, you did it and you did it very well, fantastic. But what about the reboots? When someone reboots machine, will your code stay over there or maybe not? Whenever, for example, you reboot or someone reboots the machine, then The question is, how are you going to take the control over that machine back again? So that brings us into a simple conclusion. That machine needs to connect back to you in a certain way. Maybe today, maybe later, in a certain way. So how are we able to be persistent? Well, first of all, there's a couple of mechanisms in operating system, like services, DLLs, and so on, that we can use to run the code for us automatically. Services are pretty grateful, but they're very easy to be discovered. As you saw, I had one service, and it wasn't looking good because it was running on a certain account. If it was running on the local system, and if it had an executable place in the Windows System 32 or a Windows folder or eventually in program files, then it will be okay. I mean, it looks okay. I'm not saying it's going to be okay, but it looks okay. So, whenever we are thinking about staying persistent, we do have also a couple of other places rather than the services that we can use, so it's not that obvious to be discovered. Think about the DLL that is running through the hoster of DLLs, which is SVC host. I mean, and it has a very nice name, like event viewer logger or something like that. So this is not really something to be discovered. Of course, there is one tiny thing that we should mention, is that whenever a hacker puts the code somewhere, there is a big, big chance that that code will not be digitally signed. I mean, nobody wants to take responsibility for the code that it's not legit. There used to be situations like that. Maybe there's going to be, we will have some situations like that in the future. For example, Stuxnet was a pretty interesting piece of code because the driver the Stuxnet used was digitally signed by Realtek and by JMicron. Probably not intentionally, yes, but it was signed. It means it worked on a 64-bit operating system within the kernel mode. So that's kind of really, really rare situation. Okay, guys, so what are the other stuff that are interesting? One of the things, it's notification package. Of course, WinLogon. We can use some mechanisms to distribute through GPO. What do I mean by notification package? Let's dig in. So whenever we are changing our password, and this is the thing that I was talking on TechEd some years ago, we are thinking, like, okay, if someone says that the password needs to be complex enough, the question is, who checks for this complexity? And apparently, there is some mechanism that checks for complexity. And to be able to check for complexity, you need to read the string that the user provides and make a decision. So it's going to be like what? Like numbers, characters, like small caps, and so on. So there's a lot of complexity that we can introduce. Great. So who checks for that? And here comes the small demonstration. There is a registry key entry that is called notification packages. And I'm right now on the domain controller. That means that there's this tiny file that appears by default. All of those are DLLs. SCECLI, this is actually the guy that checks for the password complexity. And this RASFM is the one that takes part into the radius authentication. But if you have a look, I do have here also my own string. And this is my DLL that I've launched over here. What is so cool about this place is that it launches every time operating system reboots. This is the step number one, so we are persistent. Step number two is that this DLL does not have to be digitally signed to be running. It's like, what? Isn't that whenever we are running operating system related features, things must be digitally signed? Well, not at all. So whenever you put your DLL over here, of course, it must be written to be responding like a notification package. It's called Password Filter Library. You can search out in the internet. You're going to find a lot of articles about it, and maybe you can write your own one. It will be pretty cool. But this tiny library, of course, does the different job. Okay, so whenever we are thinking about WinLogon, WinLogon particularly, it's interesting. This is an area that you've got whenever you are locked. So whenever user locks the desktop, and we've got it like this, here you do have the possibility to run the code. And when the user logs on, this WinLogon session goes out. So this is actually an awesome place to do something. And the reason why it's like that is because to monitor it, it's kind of hard. Of course, Of course, there are tools available like an XPerf, and you can monitor the booting process and you can check out what kind of stuff is loading during the booting process. You can even measure a time and everything, paint a nice graphs about it. Awesome. But from the user perspective, it's kind of not that nice. These tools are pretty advanced. And if you are a user, even if you are admin Shredder and you do not know these tools, I mean, how you will be able to investigate what is going on? And the nicest thing about, and this is my like a sign within my presentation, or I try to be like that, is that I always try to use the custom code. And the reason why it's like that is because if you're gonna say, okay, but that's gonna be discovered by antivirus, not at all. As long as it's a custom code, it will not be discovered by antivirus, as long as I'm not using any kind of obvious signatures that are characteristic for a virus. And probably I will not. So, making the long story short, I think it's time to have a look how we are able to stay persistent. Because whenever we do have a win login, it will launch my code every time I'm gonna log on to the certain machine or every time I'm gonna elevate myself. So, first of all, we know, of course, that admin Shredder, he opened up the script. This is what was our last thing that we did. So I'm gonna switch it to a full screen mode. Very good. So I'm gonna do what I'm gonna do right now. So let me log off and I'm gonna log back again. I'm going to log back again as one of the unprivileged user, because as you see, I'm logged on with domain admin, which is also a local administrator. And to be able to launch the code from the win login session, I mean, now it's actually for any kind of user. And any kind of local admin could do what I did with the script. So, first of all, before I log off, I need to set up the attacker. And the attacker that I will set up, he will be listening using the netcat commands on the connection using the certain ports. So what kind of stuff we are talking about right now? So let me show you. First of all, as you see, I got a connection established. Let me go to the full screen. Very good. I got a connection established on port 51 and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So what are these? If we have a look in details, like what's that? This is Netcat. Netcat is one of the very, very obvious to be used hacking tools, or just like have fun with the connecting back tools. It's used basically within the penetration testing. It's a free tool. And what I'm doing, I'm listening on the port 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the other one, of course. Why on two ports? Well, that's what I was going to do. That's what I will describe to you when I will launch a certain malware. So I'm listening on the client side. So this is an attacker. And over here, what I will do, I will simply log off. So let me log off. And let me log on back. Every time you do such operation, there is a new piece of code generated. Sign out anyway. That's true. Because the process, the logon UI that I'm injecting the DLL to, is gonna launch my DLL, and then the process is gone. That means that if you log on to the certain operating system and you are like, oh, I feel like I've got something. Oh, these are the strange executables going on. What is going on? Then of course you can go and you can find the traces, but things will not help you out because you will not find the hard DLL that is managing all the stuff. So let me show you. This is an administrator. I said that I will log on with a different user. So I'm going to log on first as a Vader. Of course, it has nothing to do with the Star Wars. And then, on that certain guy, there's going to be a tiny script that's going to launch. And let me explain you what is going on. The reason why you will see the script is because I want you to see the script. So over here, you see that there's this PowerShell. And here we are launching the attack. So right now what happened is that I listed all of the network connections that we've got around. I'll show you the script in a moment. And this is the dynamic content. So remember that because we're going to go back to this. I'm listing all of the network neighbors that I've got around using two simple things, actually. One is the NetView, which everybody knows. Of course, it may not work in every infrastructure, I agree. But the other one I'm going to use is ARP-A. And this is something that in most cases works. If someone was communicating with me, that means that I will try, I will do my best to connect to this guy, and I will see if I'm able to be administrator on that machine as well. So, having this in mind, you see I'm doing the scanning, so this is very good. And I do have this really strange encoded commands going on. So what's that? What I actually did with these commands, I have downloaded, so this command, it's an encoded PowerShell command to download this dincmd.cmd from the website. And within the script that I will show you in a moment, you're gonna see that on my website, if you go to this website, there is no actually dincmd.cmd. There is though a cmd.txt, and that cmd.txt, there is a name change, of course, to be able to execute it. I mean, txt file, it's not really executing anything. But there is one magic thing that happened, because this netcat that I've got over here, you see this? There is one guy that connected back to me. And if you wonder right now, who am I? I'm this Vader guy. And this is the attacker's machine. And if you check out the host name, of course, I'm on the node 1 right now. And node 1, it's this machine in the back. This is administrator's computer. And thanks to that, I'm able to, of course, escalate myself. Here, what I can do, I can copy certain files, for example, and so on. What's going to be my next goal? So this is pretty simple. I would like to wait for the further infection, because this Vader guy, he's not really an administrator. He's just a regular user. He's an administrator of his own computer, but that's it. And if I would like to spread within the infrastructure, I need to be able to do it. So what is really nice over here is that persistency that we've got, it's going to stay within days, months, maybe years, who knows. And what I'm waiting for here, for the malware to spread, is just a tiny click. And that tiny click, it's going to happen whenever administrator logs on, the real domain administrator. So this is what I'm waiting. It's definitely worth waiting, because when he logs on, malware is going to spread over. So what I will do, I'm just going to log off, so sign out. And I'm going to log back again using the administrator's account. And the same things is going to happen right now. So if you are wondering, like, how is it that things are launched, I will show you in a moment on the WinLogon screen that there is a process that is created whenever there is a WinLogon screen, of course, launched. It's called Logon UI that I've mentioned, and how we are able to investigate it, it's only on the top screen. So just for your information, that machine, of course, got reconnected over here. So this is me again. And if I would like to check out who am I, I'm right now a certain administrator. And this is something that allows me to leverage this position, because this is the tiny moment that once in a 6 months that a domain administrator logged on, and this is so great, and now I can spread all over. And what I'm trying to do right now, I'm connecting to the certain machine, and as you see, I'm checking out if there's a net logon share somewhere. And the way of spreading there are actually two. First of all, I'm checking out if there is, of course, somewhere a domain controller around. So this is the net logon search. Second, what I'm checking for is if I can get access to the admin share, and admin share can be only accessed if you are an administrator of the domain for the all machines that are within the domain, of if you are administrator of that computer. It might be also the local admin, but domain admin, of course, can do this as well. And what I'm doing through that share is that I'm uploading to these machines two things. One, it's going to be the DLL. I will show you this one in script. Another one, it's going to be, of course, the registry edits that you show at the beginning. Remember that strange string that appeared within the registry when I refresh the registry, credential provider? That's going to be the one that's going to appear everywhere. And you can be like, oh, whatever, let's delete it. So let's actually delete it. Reg edit. I'm going to launch it here. Here we go. And we are like browsing through all of this stuff that is over here. And we are like, okay, if there is something that runs up front, it's probably within the run. And it's probably within the run of the user. Okay, so what I will do, guys, please remember that I'm gonna delete this. And I'm deleting it. Okay, are you sure you want to delete? Yes. Of course, it's an old method for doing things, but you know, it's kind of not true. If you're gonna be like, oh, there is something within the run area, oh, that means that every time we're gonna log on, things gonna get in, oh, so I deleted it, I'm so happy. Of course, it's a fake situation. Because what's gonna happen is that I'm refreshing it right now many times, so you see that the dead value doesn't appear. It will appear if I log off and log on again. Because it's not launched through my malware, it's not launched through run. It's launched through log on UI process, as I mentioned at the very, very beginning. So let me do it. I'm gonna log off. Very good. And you see this ease of access button? So this is the way how you're able to quickly troubleshoot the situation. Is there any log on UI and so on? Because log on UI disappears when you log on. And my DLL is actually loaded within the log on UI. So if you go over here, for me, what opens is a console. And that console opens just because I did a tiny trick with something that is called Utilman. If you wonder how to do it, watch my sessions from the past year. I was talking about it. Or find registry hack Utilman in the internet and you're going to find the same stuff. What is so cool about that situation? If you do who am I, you see that we are anti-authority system. That means that right now we are the most privileged account within Windows. So taking that into consideration, what we can do, we can of course, I got my tools over here. We can run Process Explorer on the top of it and then analyze if on the WinLogon screen we do have something that is malicious. And I'm gonna search for the process that is called LogonUI. If we go to the properties, of course you see that the parent process of the LogonUI is winlogon.exe, which makes a lot of sense, and LogonUI is actually the guy that launches my DLL. You can check out, of course, the DLL list over here, and my DLL is gonna be on the list. So let me close that, and let me log on again, and let me proceed with the malware explanation. So how we are spreading? What is actually going on? So I'm logged on right now as an administrator, and at that point, I will be, of course, launching the PowerShell script again, and so on. So first of all, you probably wonder, like, why do we see this PowerShell script over and over again? Well, I got good news for you. Well, this stuff can be very easily hidden. And when this stuff is running in the back, let me go to the tool. So I'm going to take this machine out for a moment. Like that. Here we go. And what I'm going to get to is the tool. This tool, Hidewin, it's of course a custom tool. I mean, if you're a developer, probably you are laughing right now very hard because the tool is very simple. What we've got within the tool is that I can enumerate my current windows that are within the operating system. And within this year's TechEd, on the session that was called CSI Windows, it's also recorded, I was talking about something that is called Active Process Links. It's a structure that you can use to hide processes from the list. This time, what I will do, I'm gonna start Notepad and I'm gonna hide it just to show you how simple is that. So Notepad, it's starting. I got this window over here. It's called Untitled Notepad. So let's do it like this. So I'm gonna enumerate windows and I'm gonna find Untitled Notepad on the list. So as you can see, there is this. And this is this window that we've got over here. So I'm gonna click the show window. It's kind of ironic because for hiding window, there's also a function that is called show window. So it's like show window, yes, no. So here I am, what I'm doing right now, I'm gonna hide that certain window. Let me get to the, of course, Notepad. Let me do it one more time. Something wasn't perfect, so let me launch it one more time. Yay, here we go. And I'm gonna open up the tool one more time, and then let's dig in to a demo. So this is the tool. I'm gonna enumerate the window like we did. Of course, I can open up Notepad as one of the applications to hide. So Notepad, here we go. Notepad. There was a typo, but yes, here we go. There's notepad. And enumerate windows again. And then untitled notepad. And then I can either show it, either hide it. Oh, this is kind of interesting because where is this going to? Ah, it's an interesting tool. You see, there is something that is not okay. I got this window, and when I do this, it really react. Ah, okay. This is interesting because of the extended screen. I'm hiding the windows right now in front of my eyes because I got an extended mode. Let me run this up here then. Maybe it's going to be a little bit better. So enumerate the windows within this win session, and then, yay, we got it. Awesome. So it's nice that we figured it out. And what I did, I decided to hide notepad. If you check out all of the icons that I've got underneath, notepad is not here. I can, of course, show notepad one more time, and then it appears again. So I'm not really, like, you know, terminating the process. I'm just using the tiny function that will take the windows from our eyes. So this is basically it. To stay persistent, you need to figure out the way how, after the reboot, you're going to reconnect to a certain place. So what does it mean? What does it mean to stay persistent? My malware, what it's actually doing, it's communicating to my FTP server to download a couple of files. For example, I'm going to open up this CMD. You see there is a dynamic content. And what is happening is that we are establishing a netcat connection over here. And later on, we do have, of course, the infection. What's the infection about? Let me explain. So first of all, what is happening is that within my malware, and this is kind of important to be able to control, I am using one tiny feature. So let me launch it. That tiny feature, let me go to the server that I've got, which is over here. Very good. And the scanning is, the spreading is going on right now. That tiny feature, all of the files copied to temp. And the feature that I'm talking about is actually called timestamp. What I'm doing right now, I'm timestamping each machine. So the machine that was infected gets a timestamp. That means, and this is like to milliseconds, and this reports back to me. And if I'm like, okay, I'm going to attack this machine within this timestamp, as long as every machine within the infrastructure is going to ask about, hey, I would like to download the script from the website, and in the script's going to be, this machine needs to get infected, and it's going to be the only one, this is how I'm able to control single machines. So what about the situation? Well, first of all, as you see, what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to spread. So here we go. This was not found, so the network path was not found. And of course, I understand why. It's because I could not connect to the share. But later on, I'm going to connect to the domain controller. And to the domain controller, domain admin can connect. And actually, I actually did that already. That's really good. So 10, 10, 2, 10. You see? This is, I'm adding the registry, so the operation completed successfully. Let me enlarge it. And what I did, I added remotely by spreading all of the stuff. So the first of all, I copied the winlog on DLL, as you see, to the admin share system 32. I was trying to do that. Before, of course, so this is the command completed successfully area. Here we go. Before that, I was, of course, copying all of the registry keys. So let me enlarge it again. It's kind of hard because the console is moving, so I need to catch the moment. So this is the one file copied, malware ini, one file copied, and I copied it to 10, 10, to 10. And all of the registry keys are added as well. So right now, if you wonder where do we have a malware, we do have on all of the computers that we could see around. So this is pretty cool because what we are using is all of the operating system tools. And the malware spreads just using a tiny script. Of course, malware, it's not an operating system tool at all, but this is just this DLL and malware.ini. So what is in malware.ini? So malware.ini, let me go to the C windows. I'm going to open the Explorer one more time. So C, And then when we go to Windows, there is this malware.ini. This is the one that we got with this initial script, the PowerShell script that administrator copied. And here you see all of the commands that are, and this is the request for downloading the other malware files. So if you wonder what's that, this is base64. Of course, in PowerShell, you do have a function to encode the strings and decode the strings from the clear text, of course, to the base64. And that's what I'm launching here right now. This str1 script that I've downloaded as well, so this is this one. If we go edit, this tiny script does a lot of good work. This is actually the script that is launched right now. So we are creating this timestamp about the victim. So now I will know which machine is what. Later on, I am putting the data to an FTP server. In our demo, I am, as you see, building up the script. And second thing is I'm launching the commands. I'm downloading the script, and I'm launching these commands that were in this din.cmd file. And this command, it is the request for downloading this cmd.txt file that I showed you from my FTP server. So it's actually getting to the website, and whatever I put in the txt file that I've got on the website is going to be converted back to the din.cmd. So that's pretty nasty, because whoever runs that, this person will be able to spread all over the network the stuff that everybody can get. And why it's like that? Very simple. Because that tiny malware, so the get encoded command, this tiny thing, it's using, it's communicating and downloading, of course, the files through port 80. It's going on through port 80. So the question is, who can enter websites? Who can browse websites from their infrastructures? Of course, a lot of you. And this is pretty normal to have port 80 open. And this is what this malware is leveraging. So the next thing that I will do, of course, let's check out the status of the certain malware. How is it? And here we go. We stopped. So this is great. Now I can go to my domain controller and check out if the malware is there. So this is my domain controller. And as you remember, to 10.10, 2.10, things were copied. So I can, for example, go to the registry, so regedit. Very good. And I can check if I do have these malicious reg entries. And they were in the local machine, software, Microsoft, and then we can go to Windows. Very good. And then we've got current version, authentication, credential providers, and as you see, we do have a provider over there. What is pretty cool is that if we go to run, there is nothing yet. The reason why it's nothing yet is because I have to log off and log on back again to this machine to be able to launch. Now I'm launching my malware. Now I'm doing this. To be able to launch the DLL through Logon UI. And right now, if I get to Windows R, I can go regedit one more time. And I can check out what is in run. And this is the malware that launches, you see? So everything is there. And then the infection continues. And when it continues within the hidden window, this is another computer. Then we'll be, of course, spreading this all over. Local machine, very quickly to check. Software, Microsoft, Windows. Here we go. And then current version, one more time. And then run. And what we've got in run, you see this is run, is actually the malware that was created just because the DLL worked over there. And what is, again, very nice, just to show you, another port that you'll be probably wondering, like, why do I need it? So this is 1111. It was actually designed for the domain controller. So right now, I'm on the DC. Just because administrator copied some innocent script from the website. Okay, guys. So let's move along. So the next subject that we have to discuss, let me remove all of the machines. Of course, we discussed how to stay persistent and how to stay undetected. And this is what I would like to share with you, is how we are able to play with the PowerShell against, of course, hiding and detecting things. So whenever you want to stay undetected, there's a certain ways we can, of course, play with here. First of all, what we can do, we can use the PowerShell, and this is the demo that I would like to talk about. So first of all, I would do like that. We need a tiny setup that is needed to play on something that is called NTFS journal. So let me go over here. Good. And this is the data that I'm going to work on. So over here, if you have a look, all of the documents that I've got, this is kind of boring. All of it is 2010, and the time is pretty equal, and so on. What I will do, I'm going to modify the, let's say, file number 4, and I'm going to change fake to, let's say, real. And I'm going to save it. Very good. You see that, of course, it's not a surprise, date modified changed, so this is great. And the question is, how we are able to get that information? So what I'm trying to talk about right now is whenever we are thinking about listing the files just because hacker put something on our machines. Okay, if it happened yesterday, we're going to be like, maybe we could list all of the files that were placed in our desktop like yesterday. Well, if the hacker did not really think about that, then you can do it. But if he did, sorry, that's what I'm going to show you. How to cheat on that kind of parameters. So the first thing that I will do is to calculate the hashes. My logic here says that display me all of the things within my folder, within my E directory, that are within the certain characteristic. And I'm going to, of course, change this one to fake right now. And you're going to see that the hash will change. So fake data. And then I'm going to save it. Very good. So let me take this out. And then let me launch it again. What I will see are two different files, 1.txt and 4.txt. Actually, what I'm doing is that I'm comparing all of the files all together. And I, in this directory, I got two different hashes. Because 1, 2, 3, and 5, and 6, and so on files, they are all the same. Here, this file has changed. So it's going to be different. Okay, so this is how we're able to spot that. But of course, let's face it, how often do we measure hashes? How do we count hashes on the certain directories? Not really often. So let's have a look at the date. It's the last write time. And we are able to display, of course, the dates. So we can do this browsing within our directories, and then it's going to be, oh, this is the number 4.txt, and it has changed that time. Very good, guys, but I got a little bit bad news. Let's have a look at the properties that we can change. So as you see, we've got here the creation time, last access time, and last read and write time. So this is something that we would like to change. Get set. And particularly set says that we are able to change that. So let's change it. Let's cheat a little bit on the dates that are set about a certain file, this 4.txt. If I go to the properties, of course you see that. Yes, it's a January 1st, modified my 15, 2 minutes ago, good access, January 1st, and so on. So let me go back with this. Of course, if we would like to cheat on that, that's not a problem. Here, I get a small script, and that tiny script allows me to overwrite all of the data, the properties that I just displayed to you. If you are like, okay, I want that script, no problem. If you go to the secure website, there is the tools tile. If you click on that, so secure, C-Q-U-R-E.pl or .us, then, of course, you will get the scripts within the tools folder. So let's read it. Let's do it. And then let's check out how the file changed. So you see, it's a file 4, and right now we've just cheated on the date. This file, it's like coming from 2010, which is definitely not true. So if someone knows that, and particularly hackers, they do know that, they will definitely change the date. Okay, guys, but I would like to show you one tiny thing. It's nice to be on a good side at the end. From the TZ Works, I got the tool JP64. This is a tool That is a very nice NTFS journal analyzer. So if you would like to have a look at the history, what was changed in the operating system, you can definitely use that tool. This tool, unfortunately, is not for free, but I think it's definitely worth it, and I'm using it. And it's definitely nice to see how things are looking inside. Unfortunately, forensics tools are very rare because to write them is extremely difficult. So let's have a look what the tool can do. I'm gonna launch it. And right now, we can see the full history of the file, what was happening and when. So let's see. Here, we've got the file number 4. So you see it. We got it over here. We've got files closed, file closed, file closed. And of course, data truncated. So we have this comment, file info change, file overwritten, data overwritten. So this is basic info change. So these are the things that are written as a history of the certain drive. It's pretty cool. So, of course, if you are wondering where this file is, we can, and there's also a parameter that is called show their path. So let me launch it. And that parameter allows us to check out, of course, what's the path of the file and its data. Okay, guys, the second technique that I would like to talk about is about playing with putting malware into a Excel spreadsheet. So the first thing that I will do, let me run the script. The first thing that I will do, let me display the files, because probably you were interested what we're going to modify. So let me do it like that. We don't need much. We just only need that area. So within the malware files, we've got an Excel spreadsheet, and we do have a malware.exe. This malware, it's a very tiny malware. It's just an executable that, and this spreadsheet, it's the one that we will be putting this executable into a spreadsheet. What are the ways of doing this? Of course, drag and drop. I mean, let's be serious. Let's use something that other people that want to attack your infrastructure are going to use. So here, what's going to appear, it's the modified Excel spreadsheet with, of course, the malware. The first thing, which is like unbelievably easy, and see, I'm doing everything with PowerShell. Everything I'm doing, it's PowerShell. No custom tools, just a custom script. So what I will do, I'm going to first run the command, and here, so I'm changing the extension. I'm just renaming this file. That's what I'm doing. The question is, can we open it? Well, we can try, but Excel's going to tell us that it's not really a valid file, so I'm sorry, not really. But of course, if someone renames it, there's going to be malware. Okay, this was like crazy easy. Second thing, what we're going to do, we're going to combine two files all together. And this is also one of the kind of older techniques used to put and beat executables into another type of file, particularly in Office documents. So what I will do, let me execute it. And I got an Excel spreadsheet that is here created. I'm going to open it up. And at the beginning, it asks me if I would like to recover a certain document. Of course, I would like to recover, so let me click yes. And what it does, it says, well, Excel completed opening this workbook, but something went wrong. Of course it went wrong, because there was a file inside the Excel spreadsheet, but we are still able to see that this is Excel. So this is one of the ways how we can keep files. But of course, if someone opens and repairs the files, malware will go out. Okay. Alternate data stream. So this is a pretty interesting place to store your data. And this is the place that we always forget about, because alternate data stream, it's the place that's supposed to contain information about a certain file. So the thing is that if you are downloading, let's say, scripts from the internet and PowerShell scripts from the internet, you've got a PowerShell policy, so the execution policy so-called, that is called remote signed. And whenever you've got that policy set up, whenever you try to execute the script that is downloaded from the internet, probably you will not be able to do it, unless, of course, it's digitally signed. How do we know it? Well, because of the alternate data streams. So let me run that. We do have a malware number 3. And the question is, and of course, it's a regular document. I mean, normal, completely normal document, nothing malicious inside. But of course, the executable, it's within the alternate data streams. How we're able to check for that? Well, very easily. Let me move to this directory. So I'm going to copy quickly this path. and I'm gonna move myself to this drive, and then I'm gonna use the simple dir command, and that particular dir command will allow me to display the size of the alternate data streams. So let me do like this, clean up the screen, here we go, and then dir, if we do a question mark, has this option, which is R, it's a capital R. So it's gonna be dir, capital R, of everything that I've got in my folder. And here, let's see, if I can see that. Apparently not now, so let me see what went wrong. Oh, I know, exactly, of course. I haven't really launched the whole thing. I only did the one part of that, because what I'm doing, actually, so you see that I have basically assigned, so copied the files, and that's what I did, and that's kind of true. What I'm doing, I'm leveraging a very nice tool over here. It's called MKLink. And MKLink, if you know it, it is a tool that you can use to create the soft link and hard links, sometimes called junctions. So this is something that is pretty, it's a pretty old, of course, functionality within Windows, and not only in Windows, of course. So let me run the whole thing. Yep, we got it. We've got that malware, of course, created, and now it should be fine. Because as you see, what I did, I used the soft link, and this is what you can do with MKLink, this is amazing. I used the soft link to copy data, so I opened a new link, but the link not to a file, but to an alternate data stream. So this is a malware 3, and this is the malware 3's alternate data stream that contains, of course, malware. So this is the way how you can put files into each other. And then the next file that I've got, the next step that I've got, is of course embedding. And if I save all the stuff, I'm gonna have the Excel 4 created, and inside that, at the very, very bottom, I do have the malware that is embedded. So this is kind of easy, probably you know that already. But the last thing, it's actually pretty interesting. So, what we're gonna do, we're gonna put the malware as a hex. So, and we're gonna convert an executable to a base64, and we're gonna put it into Excel spreadsheet. That's kind of cool, because it's kind of hard to find it out. I will tell you how, and tell you why. So let's launch it. We've got malware 5. I will open it up. And this is malware 5 coming. And I mean, where's the malware? I'm sorry. Well, the malware is in the hidden sheet. Like you see, some helpful data. And if we click OK, there is exactly this executable coming out. So if you want to extract it, no problem. You take all this stuff and then you convert it to an executable. So let's have a look. I do have here a script, extract malware. This is the one that you can also find on my website, so everything that I'm talking about is there. I'm gonna take that particular malware 5 and I'm gonna extract the string from the Excel spreadsheet. So let's do it. Bam. And this is the malware that is extracted from that spreadsheet. I mean, of course, it was base64, so that's kind of easy. Okay, guys. The next stuff that I would like to show you is actually the fact that we are able to leverage our position. And to leverage our position, this is actually where hackers, when they have fun. So what you can do, I mean everything. Everything that will give you the privilege. We already do have a privilege. We are already spread it. Our malware is already working within our infrastructure, in a whole infrastructure, using the simplest possible mechanisms, just because of one tiny click, just because an administrator was thought that he is downloading the legit script. And it was kind of legit, yes? So, what kind of things we can get? Well, first of all, it's really nice to think about password as a way of getting access somewhere. I'm sure that you on this conference heard about like pasty hash attacks, getting passwords in a clear text, this and that. I was speaking within my presentations about it a lot, and we had on the session yesterday actually the premiere of the very cool tool that I'm sure you know. It's called Mimikatz, but we our team had an exclusive version of it, so the first like in the world version that allows us to grab the certificates from the memory without leaving any trace on the drive. So, I mean, things that we can do when you are an administrator are like bottomless. I mean, there's like, you can just do whatever you want. So, let's have a look what kind of stuff we can get within 5 minutes. So first of all, what I would do, I'm gonna log on to one of the boxes just to describe what kind of components we can play with to be able to get the password eventually somewhere in the clear text. So first of all, there is one tool that I really like, and it's called SAPD. I don't want to repeat myself, that's why I will do it very fast. Just to remind you, I know that many people are using it. I'm really grateful for that. It's a tool that was written by our developer, Michael. And this tiny tool can grab the password from the accounts that the services are running on. Boom, the password number one. Okay, so what else can we do? Maybe let me do the full screen. It's going to be a little bit comfortable. Very good. If you are, for example, a fan of using Mimikatz, no problem. Mimikatz will give you all of the people's passwords. Here, we are able to list them. Clear text passwords, it's nothing really uncommon because the clear, well, passwords are not in a clear text in a memory, but they're decoded because we are debugging the local security authority's app system. If you are thinking about, are we able, for example, to get the password from the application pool's identities? No problem. Here, as you see, I was able to do it. What kind of command helped me out? Appcmd list app pool. This is the name of the application pool, and I'm exporting this to text. So everything that I've got over here as the application pool settings running on the custom account, this is it. I mean, guys, grab the passwords from my operating system, it's not a problem. Over here, to extract hashes, I'm just doing it right now. What I'm using this for, it's a ntds.did, of course it's an Active Directory's database. DS users, Python, it's a part of the ntdsx toolkit, so ntds extractor. It's a set of the Python scripts written by one of the security guys that allows you to export hashes from the domain controller, not on the live system, but from the snapshot, actually, which is pretty cool because you are not really touching local security authority subsystem. That's really awesome. Normally, local security authority subsystem, when you touch it, when you poke it, it's going to say, I'm sorry, 30 seconds, I'm shut down. Goodbye. I don't like to be poked. So, this is of course, what we can do. A couple of other things. Of course, whenever you are using the group policy preferences, this is one of the things that we should definitely have a look as well. To add a little bit of spice to the whole story, I will do it because I can do it, for example, from one of the machines that will not be necessarily a domain controller. So I'm going to do it from here. I'm going to close the script. I don't need it anymore. And over here, I'm going to go view, full screen mode. And then over here, within the CMD, I got two scripts. One is the Invoke Mimikatz, written by Joe Białek, which is a very nice PowerShell edition of Mimikatz, like really cool. And I'm going to use this script, also written by one of the security guys. It's everything is on the web. I mean, you don't have to write your own script as long as there is someone that did it. We do have also a lot of custom tools, but I mean, if there's something, you just use it because we don't have really much time. And that tiny script, I'm going to, of course, copy the name first, maybe. I'm going to, of course, run, and that will give me the access to the clear text passwords that are within the group policy preferences. How I will do it? Well, let's say PowerShell ISA, which is the nicer version of it, and I'm going to run it as administrator, and then I'm going to get the passwords from the clear text. Actually, I don't have to be running that as an administrator because the password can be decoded, and that's what we are doing right now. So, second thing, let me open up the script, and this script is on the desktop. So, bang, bang, we do have the script, open, very good. I'm going to launch it first, and right now, what I can do, I can do get GPP password, and then I press enter, and what it does right now, it lists the group policy preferences from, of course, the domain controller, and as you see, guys, what I see is the clear text password that was configured within the preferences. Of course, to be really fair, I need to mention that every time you configure the password within the preferences, you are warned. You got a warning. So, of course, if you are like, if this is surprise, I mean, it should not be because you are warned. But if you ignore this warning, be aware that everybody else will be able to see this password as well. Okay, so making the long story short, I would like to show you how the service works. So the service, remember we listed the one that was red and I said, oh, this is something that I've got running as an administrator account. I would like to show you how it actually works. Because if I do have Netcat, as I had with the malware, I'm able to pass the commands to the certain server, either in an encrypted way or not, encoded way, I mean Base64 or not, that doesn't really matter. What I would like to show you is that I'm able to actually install and get all of the files and install a certain service, and I would like to show you how does it work. First of all, I'm here logged on as a certain administrator, let me show you, for example, how we are able through Netcat to download a certain files. So first, how to do it. Second, how the service works. So as you remember, within the domain controller, we do have here this connection. I can run hostname, and this is Netcat connected on a certain port, and I can pass commands over here. If, of course, machine has connection to the internet. So here within the PowerShell, I do have a lot of commands, and these commands are Base64 encoded. What I will do first, I'm gonna move myself and check out what is on the drive. And here there is the services folder. The tab is not working. And I will check out what is inside. And basically there is nothing. What I will do, I'm gonna get the command and I'm gonna copy it just to show you, just for the demo purpose, how we are able to download a code on a certain machine. And that command will execute, and let's see if we've got stuff over here. As you see, I got already one file. And that's how I can literally, one line by line, download an executables, download my tools over there, so everything. So another tool, just to show you, paste, bunk. It's kind of longer because it's gonna be a DLL. Here we can check, I got a DLL. So through Netcat, I'm uploading all the tools. Okay, guys, I'm gonna move to that machine, to the other node. And this is the service that I'm talking about. Yeah, so technically, we couldn't even run it over here on the domain controller. That doesn't matter really because the service is a service. And that service over here, it's already working. So just to show you what is this about, so Windows R, services, MSC, bunk. Let's have a look. This is this WinInit password logger service, and it is actually running on this executable that we will be downloading from the internet. And it's logging on, running on the administrator. By default, we can start it as a local system, and that's what I would like to show you, of course. That, of course, it runs also on a local system. One just tiny thing, because it's easier to run things as a local system. Let me go to the services backup over here. And whenever you are launching the service, it's easier to set it up to start automatically. And the reason why I'm saying this is because whenever, of course, you are running service, you need to specify the credentials. And these credentials must be known. Maybe you don't know them yet. So it's nicer to start them automatically. When it starts automatically, let me show you how that's going to be. We're going to do it on the domain controller just to download the whole package. So let me dig in. So domain controller, that's going to be the one that we've got. And the copying of the service is going to happen on Windows 8 client. So view, full screen mode, and let's dig in. So first of all, what we need to do is to upload all of the service-related files, bunk. So we do have those. Very good. It's another file. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, and there are five files that I need for the service to work. So Control C, and then Control V, paste, bunk. And the last one that I need, it's gonna be in here. Paste, bunk, executes, great. Here you see we do have a lot of stuff. So this create WinInit, WinInit logger service, it's a bat. I can execute it. I will click enter and I will click paste here. So the reason why I'm not tabbing it is because of this netcat. So here I got the service running. Okay guys, so let's move back to the domain controller and let's see what is going on over there. This is a domain controller, very good. I'm gonna log on. And that's gonna be our last thing for today, is to see that if the service is running or not. That particular service, let's go to the services.msc. Services.msc, bank. We can sort by the description, it's over here. You see it's not running, okay. So we can go to the client back to the attacker's machine. Let's dig in. And we can do net start win init logger svc bunk. And then the service is starting. Okay, awesome. So we can take this out and we can go to the domain controller and let me show you. First of all, what we're gonna launch is explore.exe. Bunk. Very good. What the website's gonna be that I will open, it's Twitter. Twitter.com. And we can add it, whatever. It's a server, of course. It's not recommended to go to this place over here like that on the server, but it's just for the demo purpose. So let me add all the stuff. This is the first time I'm entering this web page. And here, I got the possibility to enter credentials. And that's what I will do. So let me log on as, let's say, who? Pula at test 123, whatever, PL. And then it's going to be techhead 2014. Sign in. Of course, I don't have an account like that. Nope, I don't want to. Well, not a surprise. Wrong username and password. Well, it's great to hear that. But on the other hand, on my other website, that if you want, it's going to be running all the time. You can check out te13stderr.plwcereport.log. If you go to the very, very bottom, there's a lot of logs. There's this one. I do have the username and the password in a clear text. So how this can be? If I, for example, enter the same story, put the same story over here in place, like Facebook, well, no problem. Let's add Facebook. Of course, it's super trusted. Mm-hmm, uh-huh. Okay. Okay, perfect. Goodbye. Ugh. All these commercials. Okay, good. So, here, the same story. Pula at test 567.pl. I'm going to enter TTTTRRR, something characteristic. Okay, of course, not a surprise. But if I go to my website, it's a real life website. What's going to happen is that that tiny service gives you the password back again, this time from Facebook. So what the heck? So what is going on is that I do have the provider running as a service. Everything is legal. It's kind of funny. WinInit library is giving me this information before the tunnel is established. If you want to have a look, WinInit, this is the provider that you can check out. And this, of course, will help you out to pass the information to the tunnel, and this is what I'm listening to. Everything is legal. So, let's have a look. If you change your password, of course, if you log on somewhere, well, the sad fact is that I will know. The last thing is to have victims to get more targets. And this is what our malware was doing. As you saw, we were spreading all over the infrastructure, and our goal is to get deeper, to get more, and to automate our actions. Okay guys, to summarize, we talk about several things, how to become a hacker. What is the hacker's mandatory checklist? Stay anonymous, I showed you Tor. Know your victim, you can check out all of the websites that you've got running within the internet, ARIN, repair.net, that contains who is, information about who is the target. Use the social skills, because technology is currently so good that you need to, of course, do this tiny thing that's going to make the human being to click somewhere. Because we do have all of these firewalls, all of these appliances, and this is all working great. So having that in mind, it's nice to touch something that is vulnerable to a certain situation, which is, of course, a human. Stay persistent, because after the reboot, you need to be there. Stay undetected, because otherwise people's gonna delete your stuff. And use victim to attack more targets to be able to, of course, spread all over. Summary for administrators, because as I said, at the end, I'm at the good side. Learn that stuff. The best book to read, I always say, it's a Windows Internals by Mark Rusinovich. And if you want to know security, definitely start from this place. Because whenever someone is using custom code, even that custom code executes in the known places. What I showed you today, it's the WinLogon capabilities and the fact that I could launch the DLL through the Logon UI through the process that disappears. How do we know it? Well, because we read books. We read the articles, we read white papers about Windows security internals. Thank you so much. Hope you're going to stay safe, and I wish you a nice day and enjoy the rest of the day. Thank you so much. Paula Januszkiewicz was speaking.